It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last month, Allegheny County Jail expanded its interdisciplinary patient care program. The program puts medical professionals on every level of the lockup rather than operating out of a central location. Dr. Ashley Brinkman is the Health Services Administrator at the Allegheny County Jail and joins us now. Dr. Brinkman, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you. Good morning.
Briefly, how does moving medical care to levels versus a centralized facility make a difference in the delivery of the medical care?
So bringing it down to the patient means that there's a lot fewer logistics that can interfere in terms of who all and how many and how often we can see patients. But more importantly, it brings a treatment team associated to each of the areas for the patients. So rather than the providers working in somewhat of a silo, they're all working together to serve that one patient at that one time.
Does it speed up the process in responding in case of maybe a medical crisis?
Yes, it does. And we've already seen some of those examples come up that we were able to make sure that care got to them faster than what it would have should they have been following the previous setup.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an idea of what the medical crisis was?
So because the team was able to be seeing the patient a little bit sooner than they would have been waiting, they saw some unusual lab values when they were doing their standard primary care visit and were able to get them more urgently to a higher level of care so that they could get taken care of because of those warning signs that we found.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a silo. So how was healthcare set up prior to this? Was everything on the ground floor? Was it in a different building? What was the setup?
Sure. So the setup, most of level five is related to healthcare services, and we had what would be set up like an outpatient primary care clinic there. Several different locations to see patients, but that also means that if there are any separations between patients, they couldn't be there at the same time. But that was also only primary care. This new concept and modality of services is that primary care is joined by nursing. We have some behavioral health team members as well, and we're all able to treat the whole patient.
All right. You talk about care providers in different locations. Does this stretch them out? What is the current patient to staff ratio?
Oh, I wasn't prepared with ratios, but previously, you know, you had an entire list of patients throughout the entire facility that were waiting for an appointment, and a primary care provider was just looking to see how many can I take care of today. Now we have it broken down that you're only focused on one level of patients as opposed to the whole facility. So you're able to target in a little bit faster on the patients that have the highest needs for you.
Okay.
So instead of the whole building of 13 to 1400, you're now only looking at 3 to 400.
Okay. So as you're dividing the staff, did you have to actually add staff because they are in different locations?
No, we were able to have these services going simultaneously. That way, we're using the same resources that we had before, but we're using them differently. And it seems to be first run results of the program shows us that we're actually working a little more efficiently than we were before.
How will you analyze that efficiency? I mean, because it is new. How will you analyze it over the months ahead? What's your process for doing that?
We're starting to look at initial patient requests. So the first, when a patient has requested services for the very first time, and seeing what that wait time looks like for them to get their first appointment and then follow-up care. But then we're also looking at the overall grand scheme of what their whole care looked like. So did they get referrals out to specialties? Did they have a different treatment plan that came out of how this is going on. So there's small picture and big picture things happening at the same time.
Mm-hmm. The county jail has struggled to hire and retain staff, you know, system-wide, if you would. The warden's report from October said there were staff vacancies, including healthcare staff vacancies. So do you have enough right now? Are you still looking to fill those vacancies among healthcare providers?
We will definitely always be looking to fill vacancies, because being able to fill the vacancies means that we can continue expanding programs and services that are available to our patients. But what we're able to do and what we're doing right now was built on the amount of staff that we have currently on our team. So yes, we'll look to hire more, but that just means more services than what we're doing now.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about you as a healthcare provider, you as a doctor. What more would you like to be able to do in the future for your patients?
Just for clarity's sake, because I know some people care about what that means, I am not a medical doctor. I am a behavioral health professional by trade. So just so that that's clear for the public also. But the things that I'd like to be able to see are more outpatient level of care services. So whether that means short-term therapy, or it might mean bringing in alternative wellness programs to support, so that we're not only relying on things like medication, and potentially maybe we'll see occupational therapy in the future. But those are the kinds of things that our department is looking at right now and how to strategize.
So you'd like to see more therapy as part of the overall mental health care for those who are in the jail?
Yeah, that's one aspect of it.
The announcement about the expansion, the interdisciplinary patient care program, came after University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work released the results of a survey that showed those incarcerated at the county jail had high levels of dissatisfaction with the healthcare services. Was this expansion of the program directly connected to the release of that survey?
It was not. It was something that we were doing long-term research on how we were going to be able to find the best way to serve the patients. So we had done legwork on talking to other facilities, how they do their services. We visited other facilities, and we were consulting national practices. So it just happens to be not an overall coincidence, but that's just when we were ready to start those services, and the expansion is similar to when that survey got produced.
So it wasn't in response to, but did you take that into consideration as you move forward?
I think what we found is that what we were intending to do to change our services, we're going to directly impact what our patients had been telling us also. So that survey made public what some of our patients had been telling us.
Some people coming to the jail might not have had regular access to medical care in a while. Does that complicate how the jail provides medical care?
I don't think it complicates how we provide it, but it does mean that we need to look closer at the patient to see what all their needs are.
Is this preventive care, or is it just responding to that illness, maybe that medical complaint by the person who is incarcerated?
The overall goal is for it to be able to allow for preventative care and not only be working from responsive care. But at the moment, you know, we're trying to get caught up on the things that the patients are asking for, so then we can translate that directly to preventative afterwards.
Doctor, according to Warden Harper, the jail has expanded its methadone medication services as part of the facility's medication assistant treatment program for individuals who experience opioid use disorder. Who is eligible to receive the methadone now under this expansion?
With the new expansion, we are looking at anybody who was receiving methadone care in the last month. So that they've already been an established treatment provided from a community provider within the last month.
And who was previously only eligible prior to this expansion of the assistant?
Go ahead. Sure. Before that, our medication-assisted treatment for methadone services were only available to pregnant females so that we could provide the safest pregnancy possible.
And finally, doctor, what about those in the jail without a prescription prior to coming into the facility, but who still suffer from opioid use disorder? Can you address their needs?
So what we are looking at right now is how we can serve them. At the moment, we don't have a concrete answer that I can give you how we're going to be able to treat them.
Dr. Ashley Brinkman is the Health Services Administrator at the Allegheny County Jail. Dr. Brinkman, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. On Tuesday, November 8th, people across Pennsylvania made their way to school auditoriums, houses of worship, or local community centers to cast their ballots in the midterm election. And anecdotally, election officials said there were a lot of people coming out. The New Pennsylvania Project is one initiative that's been working year-round to register and mobilize voters, particularly young people. Kadita Kenner is the chief executive officer of this project and joins us now. Kadita, welcome back to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me, Kevin.
Kadita, you and the people that worked on this project were in Philadelphia yesterday. What were you doing there?
We were celebrating. Wins are so hard to come by. And so we wanted to celebrate the organizers and all of those other organizations here in the Commonwealth that are doing the work of getting the electorate to be expanded and to get voters out to the polls.
To be clear, you're not celebrating a candidate's particular victory. You're celebrating your efforts to get people registered and actually then take the next step and go and cast their ballots.
Absolutely. The New Pennsylvania Project, we are not aligned with any political party or candidate. It is our goal to get to the 1.7 million Pennsylvanians who are unregistered or not voting in this time.
1.7 million who are eligible but unregistered. So how does your effort to mobilize voters who you do register and those who are not registered, how does it look different than other efforts?
So it's a year-round effort for us. And so because we are not aligned with a political party or any political candidate, we're doing this work year-round. We're engaging communities on a year-round basis. There's reasons why 1.7 million Pennsylvanians have chosen to remain out of the electorate. It's because they are not believing in the political process. Perhaps they may not believe in a political party or a candidate. And so we're having to have really real conversations with these folks at their front doors, where they are in their communities, to get them engaged and want to come out and cast a ballot. And I'd like to say that, you know, in addition to doing the voter registration, we're doing the mobilization while we do the registration, because we're having these meaningful conversations with them as we register them to vote to ensure that they actually come out to the polls.
So how's the mobilization different?
Mobilization is different because, you know, you have to get these folks to actually show up to the polls, right? Election day for us in Pennsylvania is a Tuesday. In addition to the fact that now that we have early voting, which so many took advantage of, which we're so appreciative of, because that is how we're going to get folks mobilized to the polls. And so we can have conversations about getting you registered to vote, but the mobilization effort is much different in getting folks to actually show up to the poll on election day or complete a mail-in ballot that will not get rejected.
So when it comes to registering and mobilizing voters, are you focusing on any particular group of people?
We absolutely center communities of color. We center the immigrant communities and we center the youth. These are all the communities who have been historically and politically disenfranchised from the system. And we want to make sure that they are getting the attention that they deserve so that they can come out and make their voices heard so they can begin to get their needs met.
Preliminary numbers from the Department of State indicate that voter turnout statewide was about 61% here in Allegheny County, about 60%. As you just mentioned, your organization does have an emphasis on young voters. Anecdotally, while you were celebrating in Philadelphia yesterday, what have you heard about whether young folks actually did cast votes?
You know, it's interesting about the youth vote because, you know, so many try to poll these young folks and ways in which you cannot reach young voters at this time. They are not going to answer your phone and they may look at your text messages and not respond. And so it is our belief, and we're still waiting on official numbers, but we believe that young voters came out in record numbers in this election and cast ballots in ways that were convenient for them. A lot of them using the vote by mail opportunity, particularly those who are away at school. And so we're really looking forward to seeing the final numbers. But we know internally that the youth that we engaged throughout this process this past year and got to turn out to vote. They came out in record numbers, and we're so grateful for that. As you mentioned, Allegheny, we spent so much time at Chatham University. We spent so much time at the University of Pittsburgh. And so we're really excited to see what's going to happen out of those two areas when we get our final numbers.
So how do you know that your preliminary information is accurate, that they came out in record numbers?
Just based upon our exit polling that we have done internally, based upon the conversations that our team is still having, we are still out on the street. We were back out on the street just yesterday, registering more folks to vote and engaging those that we did register to vote and asking them this question: how was your voting experience? So we're out here talking to the folks that we actually registered to vote past this election to find out how the experience was so that we can get them to turn out for the next election. Here in Pennsylvania, we vote every 6 months. And so this last election is done, and now we need to prepare for the next one this coming May.
Hence the year-round effort by your organization.
Absolutely. And that's what makes this so important, is that we are not here for any political cycle. We are here for our year-round initiative to make sure that people and communities who are often neglected get to see our faces on a daily basis.
1.4 million mail-in ballots were requested. More than 80% were filled out and returned. Any idea from your exit polling, your questioning of young voters, whether they preferred the mail-in versus the in-person?
It really just depends with youth voters. I mean, some that are away at school, the mail-in ballot option is very convenient for them to ensure they get their votes cast, particularly if they're going to have class on Tuesday and not able to break away during that time period to vote. Or those young voters who are working and working 2 and 3 shift jobs because they're making $7.25 an hour minimum wage and are unable to get to the polls. For them, being able to use a vote by mail ballot was very convenient for them and their lifestyle and the amount of work that they have to do to make ends meet. So we'll look forward to having the official numbers soon. But it looks like young voters were just happy to be able to vote in many varied ways so they can get their voices heard.
Earlier, we talked about the groups that you focused on, voters of color, also youth. But what about people in rural communities? What does mobilizing voters look like there?
You know, we didn't skip any area. We were in urban Pennsylvania, suburban Pennsylvania, ex-urban Pennsylvania, rural Pennsylvania. We left nobody unturned. And so it does look different. The conversations can be a little longer. There's more efforts that need to be involved if we're going to mobilize these folks to vote. But we were having these conversations throughout all of Pennsylvania, and we will continue to do so for 2023.
And very, very briefly, what's coming up next? Are people election fatigued? I mean, because you're going out there and registering again.
They are not fatigued. I think they're energized today. And anyone who wants to help the New Pennsylvania Project, please know we're going to take our efforts to Georgia later this month and help out in the effort there. And if you're interested in working with us, please visit our website.
Kadita Kenner is the Chief Executive Officer of the New Pennsylvania Project. Kadita, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Drinking straws have become a poster child for the harms of single-use plastic. They don't biodegrade, and when they end up in the ocean, they can get stuck in animals' noses, throats, and stomachs. Lots of companies have started to make alternatives, and Pittsburgh business leaders want to bring those types of manufacturers to the region. 90.5 WESA's Ann Lee Herring reports on one company that's considering the move.
It's easy to find eco-friendly straws, whether they're reusable, compostable, or just no straw. But Juliana Keeling says her company, TerraVive, makes the most user-friendly version.
And when you open it, it looks just like a regular straw, unlike, you know, the godforsaken paper straw.
She says it performs just like a regular plastic straw, but it's not plastic. It's made from plants, like corn and sugarcane.
And then we are actually molding that and turning that into the products that you see here.
She points to a table with way more than just straws. There are school lunch trays, restaurant takeout containers, disposable knives, spoons, and cups, all made from plants. TerraVive sells these items to large businesses across the U.S. and abroad. But Keeling didn't start out intending to invent the latest technology in straws. She was actually researching gel caps in high school. That was around 2010.
And each year after that, I continued to refine that project.
She was paid to continue her research in college at Washington and Lee University in Virginia.
And then the business piece of it really started to take hold. One day I decided to ask my advisor, I was like, you know, I really want to see if I can turn this into a company. What do you say if I take a year off, use my stipend, and then take a year off? Rather than coming back to school.
She got internships at tech companies in San Francisco, where she learned how they grew. When she came back to Virginia, she finished her degree and did stints at two business incubators. And she started to get a little bit of press.
There was a picture there of Juliana holding, I think, you know, some straws and some cutlery in a tray, and she was sitting there smiling.
Joe Swider spotted Keeling in a local newspaper in Richmond. He says it described TerraVive as making biodegradable and single-use products.
And I said, that's kind of interesting, because, you know, I've paid attention to where a lot of the regulations are going, and a lot of city, states, countries, and regions are banning plastic and styrofoam.
They're now business partners. Swider's chief operating officer, and he helped to find the 16 factories scattered across the country that make TerraVive products today. He says the business hasn't taken any venture funding and is making a profit based on sales alone.
So we're looking at what's going to be in the best interest for us for the next stage of growth.
It might be a move. He and Keeling have been scouting out sites for a new research and development facility. They want to bring down the cost of their product without sacrificing quality, and eventually they want to open a plant. They're not sure Virginia's the best choice.
All of our key core anchor clients are not in Virginia, and we've tried really hard to, you know, try to win some key clients there. So that kind of tells us that, you know, maybe Virginia isn't the best spot for our business to be in.
Keeling says if TerraVive expands elsewhere, it'll either be in Pittsburgh, where Swider grew up, or Austin.
What I know of the three cities is, like, they really couldn't go wrong with any of them.
Brent Wistrom reports on startups for the Austin Business Journal. He covered the same beat in Richmond earlier in his career. He says there's a lively startup scene there.
But I totally understand, you know, maybe looking at a Pittsburgh or an Austin just because of some of those corporate relationships. And there's something to be said for having a new start in a new town, too.
But government connections could keep TerraVive in Virginia. The company likes being close to lawmakers in Washington because they influence federal contracts. What would make Pittsburgh worth the move? I'll break down how they're deciding tomorrow. On Lee Herring, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, a Pennsylvania doctor is the first to face discipline from the Department of Health for approving a person's certification for a medical marijuana card without reviewing her medical record. Thanks to our team, Emma Furry, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.